Open Floor is brought to you by T-Mobile. This baseball season, T-Mobile customers can get a free season-long subscription to MLB.tv Premium. Sign up by April 10th at T-Mobile.com/MLB or sign up for MLB.tv while on T-Mobile's network. We're also brought to you by Harry's Razors. Superior razors ship straight to your door at half the drugstore price. Get $5 off your first order with the code OPENFLOOR at harrys.com. And by FanDuel. Now that baseball's back, you can try the fun and competition of daily fantasy risk-free for up to $10. Just go to FanDuel.com and enter the code OPENFLOOR.
I love sports, and I love to play. And that was the way I was able to express myself. I couldn't talk. I was very shy. And that red hair and freckles and big nose, just couldn't say anything. But basketball was the place where the light was shining on me. And the game was my religion, and the gym was my church.
You had Donald Sterling. So what was that, when he comes in and he buys the team, what was that atmosphere like where you were practicing, where you were working out? I mean, all of that.
It was
what
so
was
bizarre.
That climate
it was the
like?
Alternate reality of Donald Sterling and Clipperdom, and as bizarre as can be.
Hi, everybody. This is Lee Jenkins from Sports Illustrated, and welcome to a new episode of Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast, where every week we go inside the journeys of players and coaches. Today, we're pleased to welcome a Hall of Famer, one of the 50 best players in NBA history, and certainly one of the most interesting, Bill Walton, who has just written a sensational memoir, Back from the Dead, that explores his childhood in San Diego, his legendary career at UCLA, his championship season in Portland, his other gigs as a lumberjack, a law student, a broadcaster, and a deadhead, and of course, the many hardships he faced along the way, with his speech, his feet, his back, and Donald Sterling. Bill, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us.
What a pleasure. What a privilege, Lee. Great to be with you again, and great to share the dream, because I know how hard you've worked in your life to create opportunities, to create possibilities. And for me to be here, who would have ever thought? It's been a long, strange trip, and now to be able to be here at Barnes & Noble, at the Grove in Los Angeles, oh my gosh, just down the street from where I went to college so many years ago.
Bill, I read the book. It's fantastic. Yeah, there's
the
so
one.
Many incredible stories. Yeah, 1 million. And, you know, one thing I kept thinking about reading is, you know, you wrote a little bit about just about your speech problems when you were a boy. And
I'm a lifelong stutterer.
And how that affected your life. And at some point, and about being shy and a little withdrawn when you were young. But at some point, clearly, that changed. And I was wondering when that was, how that break
was made. I was 28 years old in an encounter with Marty Glickman, the legendary Hall of Fame broadcaster, the author of Fastest Kid on the Block, the subject of HBO's incredible documentary, Glickman. He and Ernie Vanderway were best of friends from their days together in the beginning of the NBA in New York on the Knicks. And Marty was the Chick Hearn and Vin Scully all in one of New York. And he's the one who taught me, who gave me the lessons of how to learn how to speak. And he was just an incredible spirit and soul, and he was very much like John Wooden, an absolutely brilliant teacher. He knew how to instruct. He knew how to guide. He had been there himself, and I do not know if Marty was a stutterer, but he was a professional speaker, and so he taught me how to learn how to speak. And so here was this incredible opportunity. I grew up being unable to speak at all. I couldn't say hello. I couldn't say thank you until I was 28, until I met Marty. And learning how to speak is my greatest accomplishment and everybody else's worst nightmare. Basketball, academics, they were the easiest parts of my life. And I grew up in a very academically oriented household. No sports interest at all from my parents. But I love sports, and I love to play. And that was the way I was able to express myself. I couldn't talk. I was very shy. And that red hair and freckles and big nose, and just couldn't say anything. But basketball was the place where the light was shining on me. And the game was my religion, and the gym was my church. And we didn't have any money. We lived paycheck to paycheck. And while we didn't have any material possessions, we had everything. We had the greatest life ever. And then after great success early on, tragic failure early on, and then success and then failure, because my life has really been marked, Lee, by these meteoric climbs to the top. And then thinking that I've made it and I'm going to be there forever, these catastrophic health crises. And it was during one of these when my whole life had fallen apart and the doctors were telling me they're most likely going to have to amputate my foot. I came across Marty, who was in Southern California on business, and his relationship with Ernie Vandoy brought us all together. And it was on that day, that moment, in a very brief meeting where he just laid it out. His final words were, take what I've just given you and apply it to the way you learned how to play basketball from guys like John Wooden and Lenny Wilkins and Jack Ramsey and on Gene Shue, Don Chaney, Paul Silas, ultimately Casey Jones and Red Auerbach. And I still apply all those learning methods and techniques that I got from Marty to this very day. Because once you're a stutterer, you're always a stutterer, and I still stumble and fall. English is my fifth language after stammering, stuttering, spitting, and what else is out there right now? I'm brain dead.
You know, one of the parts of the book where you're probably most critical is of a shoot first point guard at UCLA, right? Tommy Curtis.
Tommy Curtis. Worst teammate I ever had.
And it made me think about sort of how you conceive of good basketball and when that was sort of defined for you the right way to play, because clearly he embodied what you felt was the wrong way to play.
For me, it was always under the umbrella, under the auspices of John Wooden. And Chick Hearn was the voice in my ear who taught me how to play. And in those days, it was Elgin and Jerry. And to the day Chick died, he always swore that Elgin Baylor was the greatest Laker ever. But to listen to Chick describe Elgin, to listen to him talk about Jerry West, that was the basketball that I knew. And then also, growing up in San Diego, we had the radio and we had the LA Times, which was the newspaper of choice in our family. And so the coverage of the UCLA Bruins as they started to come together under Walt Hazard, who was the turning point for John Wooden. And they had good players before Walt got there. They had good players while Walt was there. But Walt was the guy that put the program over the top. You know, he was the combination of Martin Luther King and Magic Johnson in the same body, who happened to play basketball. And he came from Philadelphia and he came to Los Angeles and he married one of the cheerleaders, and the rest is history. So I always have loved the speed, skill game and the passing game and the selfless nature of basketball, because ultimately, Lee, that voice, Chick, even though he was the Laker broadcaster, the way he described Bill Russell, the way he created in my mind, because with Chick Hearn, you were better off not watching the game on television and just sitting there and closing your eyes and listening to the words I view from high above the Western sidelines. And his ability to create a whole world for you, that was the world that I grew up living in, because our world in our family home was music, the radio, and books. My mom was the town's librarian, and she brought home all these incredible books just day after day, and I would devour them. And the first sports book she brought home was Bill Russell's Go Up for Glory in 1964. And my mom would get so mad because I would just read that book frontwards, backwards, upside down, inside out. And I would never let her take it back. I would hide the book from her so she couldn't take it back. And she kept saying, Billy, we're running up fines. We're running up fees at the library, overdue bills. I said, Mom, I can't give this book up. And she said, Billy, do you want to read this book or do you want to eat? And I said, Mom, I got to keep this book. So I never gave the book back. My mom was so mad. But when I first joined the NBA and I got my first paycheck, I wrote the San Diego City Library a big check in appreciation for not ever asking me to really turn that book back in. I still have it to this day, my original copy.
When you got to the NBA and you're in Portland and the foot problems begin, do you look back on how bizarre, how Byzantine the treatments that were recommended to you were? I mean, when you read it in the book, it almost seems unreal, given what we know about medicine.
I was
one
of the first major players to have these stress fractures. And most anybody else would have just said, look, my foot hurts. I can't play anymore. I can't run. It's just over. But the self-imposed pressure that I put on myself, the pressure from the team and from the doctors and from the fans and from the sponsors and from my teammates, I was not strong enough. I did not have enough self-confidence to believe that what I knew to be right, that I had to stand up for. And so ultimately, I allowed the doctor to inject my foot and ankle and leg with a pain-killing injection shot. And April 18th, 1978, we were the reigning champs. I'm the MVP of the NBA. And I went out and I played. And the bone in my foot, it split in half. And things were never the same again. But I was born with structural congenital defects in my feet.
They were taking you to witch doctors, right? Healing waters. I mean, stuff that it's incredible.
They couldn't figure out what was wrong.
Right.
And my problems were, very serious. And other people who had my problems, they quit very early on. My feet hurt all the time, Lee, when I was a child. I just thought that's the way it was. I thought because I was playing every day, all day, playing as hard as I could. So I'd be sore, particularly in my feet. And when I was in college, there was a tremendous amount of attention made about the fact that my knees were always giving me trouble. In retrospect, and now as the science and the medicine has improved dramatically, the doctors, their conclusion ultimately was that the limitations in my feet were causing the problems in my knees. And when I was 14, I tore up my knee, had to have my first of 37 orthopedic operations. And so I've got this terrible foundation. And I played for John Wooden. I lived for John Wooden. I mean, that's all I wanted to do in my life was, I knew I was going to play in the NBA at some point. But I wanted to go play for John Wooden. And what he had, what he created at UCLA in conjunction with J.D. Morgan, the greatest athletic director ever, with Chancellor Young, 29 years as the chancellor of a major public university like UCLA, and then Ducky Drake, the trainer, while we were there. He was there for 65 years and had every position, and there was not an athlete that came through the halls of UCLA that Ducky Drake did not have a positive impact on me. So these were the guys who created this world for me, and that's what I wanted so desperately.
Wish you could catch every Major League Baseball game? Now you can. Only T-Mobile customers get a free year-long MLB.TV premium subscription. That's a $109.99 value for free, so they'll never miss a game. Hurry and sign up by April 10th to catch any out-of-market game all season long. That's 2,430 games and over 7,000 hours of baseball that will never touch your data plan this season. Thanks to Binge On, only from T-Mobile, you can stream your favorite team's games without using any of your data, because T-Mobile has you covered, unlike those other guys. So get your free MLB.TV premium subscription by April 10th and catch every moment all season long. Switch to the Uncarrier today. Already a T-Mobile customer? Sign up at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Sign up for MLB.TV while on T-Mobile's network. New MLB.TV premium subscribers only. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details. Binge On available to T-Mobile customers with qualifying plan. Detectable video typically streams at DVD quality. Video from participating services doesn't count against full speed data on our U.S. network. Third-party subscription charges may apply.
So you had that world, you had Helix High, you had the Celtics, and then in the midst of that,
you had
Donald Sterling. So what was that, when he comes in and he buys the team, what was that atmosphere like where you were practicing, where you were working out? I mean, all of that.
It was
what
so
was
bizarre.
That
it was the
like?
Alternate reality of Donald Sterling and Clipperdom, and just bizarre as can be. And
were you at the naval base in San Diego?
We practiced wherever it was free. And then we would be there too long and they'd kick us out. We have to go find another place. I think the only thing we didn't do was have practice outside at a public park on a cement court with the metal fan backboards and the chain nets. But we would go from place to place. And it was the epitome of what was wrong in our world in the culture. And the NBA, I joined the NBA 42 years ago. And what it is today, it's absolutely fantastic. But when I joined the NBA in 1974, basically an expansion team, had never made the playoffs, had never won more than 38 games, never sold more than half the house to any of the games. And I became the highest paid player in the history of all team sports at the time, and the quality of my life went down. That's how great it was at UCLA. Because, I mean, UCLA was at the top. When I got there in 1970, they had won six of the last eight championships. And it was like, okay, well, that's what we do here. We win every game. We win every championship, and all our players are all Americans, and all our players are going to be the college player of the year, and all our players are going to be the number one draft pick in the NBA. And it was like perfect. And Wooden was just on top of his game. And I came in. I was his easiest recruit, but I became his worst nightmare. And I ultimately drove the guy to an early grave at 99. I ruined his life. But if you look at the pictures, of John Wooden through the years. And up until 1970, you know, through Walton Gale and Keith and Kenny and all those guys. Right. And then through Kareem and Lucius and Mike and Lynn and all those guys. And then Sidney and Curtis and Steve and John Vallely and Henry Bibby and those guys. And he's looking just fine. I mean, he's young. He's dapper. His hair is just jet black and slick back. He's got rosy cheeks and he's upright and everything. But starting in 1970, when I got there, just the incredible change physically in Coach Wooden, where he had at least two heart attacks. His hair turned chalk white. He lost all the color in his face. He just became all bent over and stooped. And that was my fault because I drove him crazy. And because I wouldn't take what he said as the truth and as the reality of the world that we were living in, because this was Vietnam and this was Nixon and this was the craziness and the lies and the deceit and the greed and the selfishness and the evil. And here we were, and the world that we were in at UCLA and Santa Monica and Los Angeles, I mean, people were not going to take this nonsense anymore. But the season kept coming and the games kept going. And so we had all these demonstrations and these peace rallies and everything. And Coach Wooden, he just, oh my gosh, the day he had to drive me home from jail, that was, he was hot.
Well, that brings me to one story that I wanted to ask you about specifically in the book, where you talk about living in Newport. I think the boys were born. Right. A friend from Oregon came down and took you to Nixon's place.
Right. I went to Nixon's
and you
house.
Left it a little bit. You said it wasn't my best moment. And then you kind of left it there. I was wondering,
I should have taken Joan Baez there with me.
What happened that day?
Well, I go in there to the Western White House. Nixon was already out. He was gone. This was 5 years after he resigned. And so we went in there and we just talked, you know, jovially. We talked about, you know, what was going on. It was the same day that the Iranians had captured the U.S. Embassy in 1979. So there was lots of political news of the day. And I didn't challenge Nixon. I didn't bring it that day. I just wish that I had someone who had the strength of personal character as Joan Baez, who right there sitting right on my side. And because this guy, man, you look back today and you say, we missed all these opportunities to do something with our lives. And the chair you're sitting in right now, it reminds me of the one chair in Coach Wooden's mansion on Margate that I could sit in. Because, you know, Coach Wooden is 5'10", 5'9", 5'8". To me, everybody under 6'10 looks exactly the same. Just little tiny guys, right? And so all the furniture is built for preschool children.
Right.
Coach had one big chair, overstuffed chair. in the corner in his den where we would always sit.
They have it now at UCLA, I think, in the Hall of Fame.
And so, and right above that chair was this letter that Nixon had written to Coach Wooden, extolling Coach's virtues as a coach and a leader and an American and a hero and all these virtues that, you know, that Coach Wooden lived and demonstrated on a constant basis. And here was Nixon trying to snuggle up to the coach right there. And I always ask Coach, can we please move this picture so I can sit in a shaft of light instead of in the shadow of darkness and evil? He never moved the letter. And Lee, in my 43 years with the coach, I never won a single argument with the guy. Never once. I never convinced him that I was right. With the one exception was the day that when we went into the Academic All-America Hall of Fame together in 94. We were in Washington, D.C., and I got him to go to the Vietnam Memorial, and we got to say goodbye and thank you to far too many of my friends, of my teammates, of my peers. And it's the saddest place on earth, and Coach, he willingly went with me.
Have you ever asked yourself why razors are one of the only products in the drugstore that are locked inside of a plexiglass case? It's because good razors cost too much. So much that people are more likely to steal razors than just about any other product in the drugstore. That's why two guys started Harry's.com. They sell high-quality blades that provide a close, comfortable shave for half the price that you're used to. Now, we're not just saying this because Harry's paid us to. All of the SI hosts are using Harry's razors, and managing producer Ben Eagle, as well as Panoply producer Dan Bloom, who is currently speaking to you right now. We're all loving the close shave that we get. And the shave gel, by the way, that it comes with is quite simply world class. They cut out the middleman and ship their products right to your door. So not only are you saving money, but you're saving a trip to the drugstore. Harry's starter set is the best option for new customers, and it's a great deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, that foaming shave gel I talked about, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, for Lee Jenkins listeners on Open Floor, we're giving you a special deal, $5 off your first purchase with the promo code OPENFLOOR. So just go to harrys.com, that's HARRYS.com, and make sure you use the code OPENFLOOR at checkout to let them know who sent you and to get that $5 off. Now back to Lee Jenkins' interview with the great Bill Walton.
When you look back at the things you were doing, even while you were in the NBA, going to law school, right, working as a lumberjack, being a broadcaster for the Mavericks, right, I believe their first broadcaster. When you look at players now, at modern players, are they experiencing life in the same way? Is their life as rich as yours was?
I love a full schedule. I keep a jam-packed calendar. I hate waste of any kind, waste of energy, waste of resources, waste of water, waste of time. And so I want to fill up my days. I do not like sitting around waiting for the game of life to come to me. And so I'm always dreaming. I read books. I like to go and hear guest speakers. I like to hear great thinkers. I like to study great people who have made the world what it is. And that doesn't happen by sleeping in. That doesn't happen by sitting in your chair at home waiting for the phone to ring. And my mom would always say when I was growing up, oh, if Billy would only sleep till 6 a.m. in the morning, my life would be so much better. But I'm an early riser. I like to get going. I want to be right in the middle of things. And I understand and accept that risk and failure are all part of this. And I grew up in that culture with my parents and with the Grateful Dead. Be curious, be willing to explore, be willing to experiment, and let's go. And let's get to that point in life where if we don't know how it's going to play out, at least we're on the edge and we can maybe tip it in the right direction. And that whole concept of getting into the game, because these days I mentor a lot of young people who are coming up and growing along, and also work with a lot of guys who have very difficult health challenges. And the fear the reluctance, the hesitation, and the doubt. And I always try to tell them, you cannot finish unless you start. And that concept of, like, don't wait for it to be perfect. Just get in the game and go. I remember one time I'm playing for the Clippers, right? And the coach, it was awful. The coach comes to me just before the game. He said, we're playing against the Lakers with Kareem and Magic and Jamal Wilkes. And probably James Worthy just getting started at the time, too. No, it was Jimmy Lynam.
Okay.
And he comes to me just before tip-off. He says, Bill, you're not starting tonight. You don't match up well with the other team. And I looked at him. I said, oh, my gosh. And so I went and I sat on the bench, and I was seething over there. And the first dead ball, I just got up and substituted myself and went in and never came out the rest of the game, and we won the game. So don't wait. Go for it. Take a chance. Don't be afraid to fail. Risk and failure are all part of life, and nobody's failed more than me. And so particularly on the business side, because I had no interest in business. Now, my greatest failure as a professional is in my hometown of San Diego. I couldn't get the Clippers over the top. My biggest mistake in business life was in the early days up in Oregon, when Phil Knight kept trying to get me to be a Nike guy. And I just kept saying, look, this is not my deal. You know, I'm a hippie from San Diego. I'm here to play basketball. I'm waiting for the Grateful Dead to come to town. I want to go ride my bike. I want to go hike in the mountains. There's all this business stuff that's not for me. And to this day, whenever my wife Lori and Phil and I are all together, they all, Lori and Phil, say, Walton, Coach Wooden was so right. You're the slowest learner we've ever seen. And Lori just shakes her head. Oh, my gosh. What an angel of mercy to be happy in love. I never thought I would be happy and lovely. Imagine being married to me. I mean, what a nightmare that is. But here I am, and just all these health problems, living with this pain on a constant basis, but something that I accepted. That's just part of the game. I thought that was the price you pay. But all this time, I spent half my adult life in the hospital, and I'm just, you know, thinking all as the years keep ticking off, and I'm just wasting away, and there's nothing happening. And I keep saying, you know, I'm never going to be healthy, and I'm never going to be happy in love. But right now, 63 years old, I've got both. No pain, no medication. I'm madly in love with my wife. She's just beautiful as can be. I can't speak for her, but marriage for me to Lori has just been bliss.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more from Bill Walton.
Baseball is back. The crack of the bat, freshly mowed grass, peanuts, Cracker Jack, soft serve filled up into a tiny helmet. It's all back. And of course, daily fantasy baseball. And if you're not playing FanDuel this season, you're missing out on the most fun a baseball fan can have. On FanDuel, you get to choose. Do I compete to win cash from fans around the world, or do I start a listener league with my friends? Either way, you get to be the GM. You study the matchups, get your money ball on, and set your winning lineup. Entry fees start at just $1, and there's no season-long commitment. You can play for just one day, or 180 days, that's the whole season, plus playoffs. And here's the best part. FanDuel's giving new players their first game risk-free. Here's what you do. Just go to FanDuel.com and enter the code OPENFLOOR. Then enter a FanDuel league or start one with your friends. If you don't win that first contest that you enter, you get your $10 right back in your FanDuel account for more play. That's FanDuel.com with the code OPENFLOOR to enter a risk-free tournament at up to $10.
I asked Luke this question a few months ago, but what is it like when the Grateful Dead are your house guests?
It's fantastic. It's what you live for. And our house is like the Grateful Dead. I mean, because every time they come to town, as the truck is leaving to go to the next town, they stop by my house and drop off all the old equipment that they don't want anymore. And so it's like being on stage in our house. And we have all the Meyer sound equipment. We have all the drums and we have the pianos. And it's just incredible, all the electronic stuff. And we keep changing it all the time. We just got a brand new beam that brings that low-end, you know, flesh-eating sound. It just comes right through you, and it's just absolutely perfect. And I love that beam, and I love my Meyer sound equipment, and I love all the drums and the rhythm and the beat and the pace, because I live the music. I can feel it. It makes me go. And it just gives me strength. It gives me power that when I'm with those guys, I can do anything. And that's why I keep turning that music on. And when I was down, Lee, and when I was sick, and I couldn't think, and I couldn't dream, and I couldn't hope, and I couldn't do anything, I lost track of the music. And because you're in such a crazed state because the pain is so overwhelming, you cannot make correct decisions. And so don't ever discount somebody who says they're going to kill themselves because their back hurts. I mean, that's what people do because it's just so overwhelming. And that was me. But now that I'm all better, I have a big sign that I wrote on a blank 8x10 sheet of typing paper. And it sits right next to my computer, right at my desk. And what it says, I took a big autograph Sharpie, and I wrote on this paper, "Turn the music on," the big exclamation point. And so right next to that, I got the remote control for the stereo. And it's always on, but I just mute it when I need it quiet, when I go to bed. But then the minute I'm there, I see that sign, I just hit that power button, and it comes right up, and it just flows right through me. It gives me the energy. It gives me the strength. It gives me the conviction that, yeah, we can get this done. Because anybody who's ever been on tour with the Grateful Dead, anybody who's ever been to the show, anybody who's ever been in the pit, they know. They know what that means, and that strength, and that vision, and that power, and that inspiration. And I never thought for all those years that I would ever get back into the pit. Because being in the pit, it's like playing in the NBA. You got to be fit, and you got to have your body working. And when I couldn't stand, when I couldn't walk, when I didn't have the balance, when I didn't have the support, when I didn't have the spine that would hold me upright, I had to sit in the back in my chair. And I couldn't dance, and I couldn't move, and I couldn't dream, and I couldn't drift, and I couldn't float. But now I can, and I'm back on tour, and I'm just the luckiest guy in the world because I never thought it would happen again.
One other part of the book I wanted to ask you about is when you took the dirt from Larry Bird's driveway.
The dirt. Oh, I love dirt. Did he thought I was crazy.
You thought you were crazy. Okay.
Oh, no. They all think I'm crazy.
But you felt there was a real significance.
They don't understand. They don't have the curse of the stolen penny from John Wooden's locker room. And that's why to this day, Lee, I carry my lucky coin. And how many times during the course? Now, this is...
I'm seeing it right now.
This is 7 years old.
What is
this?
This
is from a U.S. Special Forces officer who lost his leg in Fallujah. And there was a moment. He volunteered for 5 tours of duty in Iraq. And the 5th one, he lost his leg. He came back to the hospital in the United States. They patched him up. They put a prosthetic leg on. He got up out of that hospital, and he walked across the base to the general's office. And he walked in the door, and he said, "I'm going back. I got some unfinished business over there." And he goes over there for 2 more tours with a prosthetic leg. And he is just fighting for truth and justice and all the different things that we hope to stand for and represent. And then he comes back, and I get to know him through the Challenged Athletes Foundation. And we raise money to buy wheelchairs and prosthetics for people that don't have arms and legs. And we're out on a big ride, and I almost get him killed again. And it was just so awful and devastating. And then at the end of that day, when we did make it back, one of the guys didn't. One of the guys had to go straight to the hospital. You know, he had been injured in Afghanistan years ago, and he has brain damage and vision damage and hearing loss. And he didn't make it with us that day. But my guy, he made it all the way back. We had been hit by a car that day. And when we got back to the hotel and everybody came running out, "You guys okay? What happened? Everything okay?" When the crowd thinned out and everybody calmed down and went their way as we were getting ready for the team dinner that night, my friend, he turned to me and he reached in his pocket, and he knew the story of me stealing Coach Wooden's lucky penny.
Before every preseason, right. Before every first game of the season, Coach would pretend to find a penny. You swiped it your final year at UCLA.
And so that was the year they lost. And that was the year we lost. So right. I'm living under this curse of the stolen penny. And these guys knew this story. And so at the end of this long and tragic day, when I almost got this American hero killed again after he'd already given us his leg over in Iraq and Fallujah, he turns to me and he reaches in his pocket and he pulls out his special coin from his special forces team, the piece that binds and bonds everybody together. And he handed it to me, and he had a tear in his eye, and he said, "Bill, I can only hope and pray that one day maybe this will help you break the curse of John Wooden's stolen penny, and it has never been out of my possession again."
Wow. So between the dirt and the penny and everything else, I think you've broken your curse.
No, it's not there. This curse, you know, the only thing I didn't do to break the curse was to go to the Philippines and to try to see the witch doctor.
And carry the big 100-pound bird or whatever it was.
But this other guy who is having trouble himself, he went. And he saw the witch doctor, and he just got back, and I'm waiting for a report as to how it played out for him. Because what happens in life is that you have to do everything. And this is what you learn when you go through these catastrophic health crises with your spine. I mean, it's one thing to break your leg. It's one thing to crush your hand. It's one thing to have your ankles fused and your knee replaced. But when your spine fails and everything stops and you have no chance to even drag your way through life, you're just a helpless, hopeless, pitiful ball of useless flesh on the ground, and there's nothing. And you find the way forward, assimilating into your life that you have to do everything. Everything. There is no margin for error. It's why I bring my chair. It's why all the furniture everywhere we have is big and tall. That's why the cars I drive, everything I do. I don't ever want to go back to that space, Lee. I'm out of that. I've never been happier. I've never been busier. I haven't been this healthy since I was 13, just before I tore my knee up. And it's happening for me right now, and I want to keep this going as long as I possibly can, and that requires that second tier of the pyramid of success: intentness, initiative, alertness, self-control, focus, drive, determination, awareness of everything around you, and then the discipline. The discipline in conjunction with the sacrifice that makes a team dynamic, a group able to move forward.
Bill, I really appreciate this time, and congratulations. It's a fantastic book, and congratulations on it.
We just got started here.
I can't imagine how much you've had to talk in the last week or two, but thank you so much for fitting this into your schedule.
Who would have ever thought? You're Sports Illustrated. You're Lee Jenkins. Are you kidding? You're a hero. You have changed the world. You have made our world livable. You have brought peace. You have delivered flowers. We thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thanks to everybody for listening today and Bill Walton for joining us. If you have any suggestions for future guests, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can find me on Twitter @SI_LeeJenkins and my producer, Alan Kim, @AlanXKim, and use the #OpenFloor to get in touch with the show. Thanks again, and see you next week on Open Floor.
I just wrote out some goals and stuff. I wanted to get drafted as high as I can. I mean, the draft's coming up. We'll see.
After the regular season, after the bowl season, there is another season, draft season. As soon as the confetti rains down on the NCAA champion, a crop of college football players officially become NFL prospects. These players' new goal is to convince 32 NFL front offices that they cannot be missed. The road to the pros isn't the same for everyone. There are stars derailed by injury.
His season is over following surgery. Trapera torn meniscus in his right knee.
Blue chip talents overshadowed by red flags.
Yeah, I was like, yo, we're going to this party. Let's pop this before we go. And I thought, well, everybody else here is doing it, I guess I can do it.
QBs trying to prove they can become the face of an NFL franchise.
It's just tune out the noise and just really focus in on doing what you need to do to be the most prepared you can.
I'm Ben Glicksman, and over the coming weeks, Sports Illustrated's team of reporters will give you a behind-the-scenes look into one of the craziest and most compelling events in sports. The draft goes deeper than seven rounds. Each pick is a player. Each player has a story. Get ready. It's draft season. To subscribe to this podcast, search for Draft Season on iTunes or find it at si.com/draftseason.